Episode 4, Part 1. So this is how Gemma found herself standing at Platform 7, awaiting the 11:32 a.m. Heathrow Express. The complications of the situation weighed heavily in her mind, and the need to recover her sister ached in her soul. For Gemma had never been separated from her sister in such a way, and the connection that she normally shared with Tara felt as though it had been severed, like the memory of a phantom limb. She knew nothing of her mark other than what she had been told by Mr. Jennings, and not for any lack of effort. Shortly after being released from the clutches of Mr. Jennings' cronies, Gemma made her way out of the Savoy. Certain that she was being followed, she entered the underground and decided to take her undesired companions on an extensive tour of London. Finally ditching them and her burner phone at the Brixton station, Gemma then backtracked to Camden Town, where she took her time weaving through the streets and alleys, making sure that she hadn't been followed before returning to her flat. She would have normally used her shadow cloaking skill, but felt that it was negligible, as Mr. Jennings' people had some method of negating her powers. Gemma was as yet uncertain as to how his devices were achieving this effect, but she wasn't taking any further risks. Over the years, the two girls had learned to never get too comfortable with any one place, for the lives that they led would not permit such trivial attachments. Anything of value or significance was already in their go-bags. Gemma returned to the flat, where she quickly snatched their bags, the packet of money they had received as down payment for the now debauched job, and made her way to the door. She was unsure if the information had made it to their innominate client, or whether they would even receive final payment, yet this was of no great consequence at this time. With one fleeting glance back at the small flat she had shared with her sister the past few years, Gemma cast a time-delayed fire spell, a floating orb of undulating liquid flame that hovered in the air, pulsing like a beating heart of molten magic, yearning for its expected release. The spell, when released, would quickly engulf the flat in a sudden but intense inferno. Gemma limited its duration so as not to burn anything further than their own rooms, but made sure it burned hot enough to erase all signs of their existence here. For other wielders, and potentially Mr. Jennings' people, could use a strand of hair or a splash of blood to track her, which she had no intention of allowing to happen. The flat itself was rented under two aliases that had now perished along with it in the fire. Gemma had made sure she was not seen exiting the building, but as she did, she heard the spell take hold. She made it several blocks away before she heard the sirens of the emergency response teams, all en route to her flat. They would likely arrive to find the fire mostly burnt out. All that remained would be hollow frame and a scattering of dwindling embers. This was a reoccurring theme of Gemma and Tara's life, leaving behind ashes and hollow homes. In that moment, the echo of a forgotten memory clawed its way to the fore of her mind. The feelings of disconnect from her sister brought forth the longing and loss she felt for a mother she had never known. Fleeting images of a face cast in shadow, tears of blood streaming down a pale porcelain visage, her countenance so stricken with fear it was like a fragmented, fractured doll's face, features riddled with fine spider-webbed cracks, so faint they were like wisps of fleeting fog fleeing from the rising sun. Then the memories of pain blacked out the remembering, shoving it back in the vast recesses of her mind. Shaking off the remnants of that vision, Gemma focused on the mostly vacant streets of Camden, once again gazing about and making certain she was alone. But just how alone she felt in that fleeting moment was almost unbearable. Shrugging off the vestiges of doubt, she embraced her confidence. As none of Jennings' people had discovered her subterfuge, she felt comfortable to once again cast herself within the cloak of shadows. She wound her way through the back alleys and streets, finally emerging at the locked and enchanted doors of the Gnarly Gnome. During their first year in London, the sisters had been enjoying a quiet pint when the mostly vacant common room exploded into turmoil as two Gnarlax brawlers, a mix between a gnoll and a redcap, a particularly nasty combination, were having a heated disagreement with the stout dwarven innkeep about their bill. They began roaring about how he was trying to cheat them out of their hard-earned money and began reaching for their weapons. Bartholomew, always the considerate innkeep and one to use words rather than weapons, an oddly uncommon trait in dwarves, was trying to resolve the situation amicably. The sisters observed that these Gnarlax, predictable to their nature, were not going to be subdued by simple words. The two girls flew into action when one of the unruly Gnarlax grabbed Bartholomew. The skillfully trained sisters made quick work of the brutes, and to the dwarf's relief, they didn't even break a pint glass. The unruly creatures were thrown out onto the streets in a heap, where they promptly donned their disguises and hobbled off without any further protest. With this instance and a few other favors the sisters had performed over the years, they became close with the gruff but hospitable dwarven innkeep Bartholomew Burke, or Barty, as his friends call him. He was well aware of the nefarious nature of some of his closer patrons that frequented his establishment and their belated need for refuge, so he kept a few rooms readily available for close friends or visiting business partners. Most fey creatures that look inhuman are able to use illusion spells to help mask their abnormal features. Hundreds of years ago, when the Tuatha De Danann were long forgotten and the Fae passed from story into legend, there was a convening council of humans and non-humans. The council had decided that the existence of all magic and the magical community themselves to pass further into legend. By their decree, all creatures of the Shi were to mask their identities while in public, stay out of the politics, wars, and the evolution of the humans. In turn, the humans would stay out of the affairs of the Fae. This was mostly observed, except for in the case of wars that threatened all who lived on Earth. The hand they played in ending World War II was one of the greatest regrets of the Council of the Fae. The devastation their actions caused during the Battle of the Bulge were irreparable, turning the Ardennes Forest and 43,000 square miles around it into a permanent ice desert, devoid of all life to this day. The frozen figures of soldiers caught in their last desperate acts of destruction, like a snapshot of humanity's fear, hatred, and anger on display for all eternity. This was all explained to the mundane world as a weapon of mass destruction created by the Allied forces to put an end to the war, which in its terrible, awe-inspiring way, did just that. Unfortunately, over the last few hundred years, the rise of war, industry, and capitalism had slowly decimated the once immaculate forests and natural wonders, all in the name of human greed and power. Yet the Fae seemed reluctant to do anything about the humans slowly encroaching on their once pristine borders. Almost as if the humans' greed was slowly seeping into the once proud people of the Shi and corrupting them like an infectious parasite. Seeing as Bartholomew had played such a significant role in the breaking of the Bulge, he had decided war, death, and destruction was no longer who he was, and made a vow to never use artificery, battle magic, or a weapon again. Because of his history, the simple life of an innkeeper was all that he desired. Barty's establishment was well hidden to the eyes of the mundane, or muddies as the fae folk like to call them, which afforded him the comfort of inconspicuousness. It was likely due to Barty's hospitable nature and unwavering loyalty that there was no better place Gemma could think to hole up. She raised her hand and traced out a weave of air in an intricate pattern, something Barty had taught her for such an occasion. The air in front of the door shimmered as the faint sound of bells jingled gently in the crisp night. The smell of juniper wafted on the air, and a sprite coalesced into existence. It spoke with a small but sharp northern Scottish brogue.
"Didn't know what fucking hour it is!"
Gemma recognized the sprite as one of Barty's. She believed its name was Stella, and was the sprite in charge of housekeeping and maintenance. Gemma remembered that she was the no-nonsense type, and by the look and posture of the creature, it was not excited by the prospect of being roused from her sleep. So Gemma spoke directly.
"I'm sorry, Stella, for the late hour, and would not have called upon you if it wasn't an emergency. Barty said if I was ever truly in need, I would be welcome here. He gave me your summoning spell if we're after hours and said to tell you the phrase, money a mickle makes a muckle."
Without expression, the sprite crossed its arms and stared unnervingly at her for several long moments, the silence building like a brooding storm, but finally broke when it replied,
"Yer bum's out the windy."
Gemma breathed an inward sigh of relief, for this was the phrase she had been told to expect if all was well. She was grateful this was the case, because displeased sprites had a way of making your life a torrent of pain. Stella uncrossed its arms and smiled.
"Come on in, ye brash cunt, and make yourself at home. You'll be in the whispering pine room on the second floor, and your key will be on the bar."
With that, she disappeared and the door swung inward, admitting her into the warm comfort of the gnarly gnome. The familiar scents of ale, stew, polished wood, and tobacco smoke greeted her as she entered. The common room was large, capable of seating 100 people or more. By the dim fey lighting, she could see the familiar worn maple floors, cedar tables and chairs, with a rustic oak wood bar and a large stone fireplace that lay cold in the late hour. Gemma felt the familiarity and comfort of the place envelop her like a warm hug, and the wariness of all that had happened slowly melted from her exhausted body. Gemma spent the next couple days researching information about her mysterious target, but was unable to find any further particulars, as if this Lucian character didn't even exist. No social media accounts or any online footprint. It was as if he left no significant trace of his existence anywhere. Just another name within the sea of unknowns. She tried getting in touch with Reggie, but his old number was dead. No surprise there. And most of his frequent haunts were lacking his ruddy presence. To be honest, he had likely taken refuge out of town until things cooled down. Or, at the worst, he had been snatched up by Jennings' people. Knowing Reggie, he was likely holed up in some remote cottage, drinking whiskey by a crackling fire and pretending he didn't exist. To be honest, Gemma didn't blame him and wouldn't know what to say to the rough, rumpled geezer anyways. She would likely wring his wrinkled neck for getting her into this predicament in the first place. So perhaps it was best she hadn't found him. Most of all, she just wanted to know who had hired her for the job, where she might find him, and ask him some rather uncomfortable questions. Gemma then spent several days casing the Savoy to find where they had taken her sister. Unfortunately, after the discovery the previous night, they had heightened their security, and now knowing what to look for, she recognized they had expanded their magical disruption field, making it near to impossible to covertly get within several blocks of the stately hotel. When Mr. Jennings went anywhere, it was in the care of a large security escort, and his presence was usually obscured by several decoy vehicles and lookalikes. So with no further recourse, she settled into a state of brooding anxiety and disquieted distaste. Barty offered his assistance with helping to find out any information in regards to Tara's whereabouts, but was proven moot when both of their sources ran dry. It was as if all their contacts were suddenly afraid to relinquish any details in regards to the happenings of Jennings and his affiliates. Like a vast, desolate darkness cast its shadow over the city, and even those who live within the penumbra were afraid of the crepuscular core that lay at its umbra. Like a vast void was suckling on the fear, distrust, hatred, and anger, turning longtime friends and compatriots on one another, like a den of wolves flung into a feeding frenzy and forgetting all loyalty to the pack. Left with no other avenues of inquiry, Gemma impatiently awaited the impending arrival of her mysterious mark and the uncertainty of her future.